On the evening of September 23, 2020, the second in a series of webinars was hosted by MSU Bozeman's Initiative for Science, Technology, Ethics, and Society, entitled Slowing the Spread, How We Can Detect the Virus in Multiple Ways, featuring Dr. Blake Wiedenheff and Dr. Seth Walk, associate professors in microbiology and immunology at Montana State University. They discussed their efforts to test for SARS-CoV-2 in wastewater and expand testing in Montana.
We've been testing individuals in the community, as well as testing the community at large by testing the wastewater. And somewhat ironically, I was prepared to do this work because as a graduate student, part of my job was to ski or sometimes run around Yellowstone National Park and take samples from these boiling acid hot springs and look for viruses using molecular methods. And as Seth Walk pointed out just a couple of hours ago, it's kind of ironic that the enzyme that we use for these molecular diagnostic tests to find SARS coronavirus is an enzyme that came from the hot springs in Yellowstone. It's a thermal stable enzyme, and that's necessary because the assay to find SARS coronavirus in a patient sample requires this thermal cycling step, going from high temperature to low temperature and back and forth many times. So the enzyme that does that was isolated from Yellowstone. And it's also ironic, or I don't know what it says about the future of my career, but I went from sampling these pristine habitats in Yellowstone to now sampling these less desirable habitats here in the city of Bozeman. And I'm going to tell you about some of our findings from that surveillance. But before I do that, I wanted to just give you a little bit more background on the research in my lab and point out that if you visit my lab's website, there's two words that you won't find on the website: coronavirus and COVID. And that's because prior to this pandemic, my lab was really focused on immune systems and bacteria. As Professor Intamin mentioned in the introduction, we were studying what happens when bacteria get sick. Up here in the upper left-hand corner is a picture of an E. coli cell that's being infected by dozens of different viruses. And by studying what happens when bacteria get sick from viral infections, we discovered, or were part of a team that discovered, an adaptive immune system in bacteria that had been creatively repurposed as a molecular scalpel that can now be used to cut out defective DNA and cure genetic diseases in humans. I don't have time to tell you about how that works today, but I wanted to just set the stage a little bit about how we kind of transitioned from our work on CRISPRs to studying SARS coronaviruses. And to do that, I had to take a little bit of a refresher myself. So I just searched my inbox for COVID. I found about 1,100 emails on COVID. One of the first emails came from this gentleman here, the Vice President for Research, Jason Carter. And this came on March 9th. And from this email, it was clear that he had a pretty good sense that SARS coronavirus was going to be a major problem for Montana, and that the university had a role to play in addressing this pandemic. So he called all of us to this meeting, and he had a hard question for us. And the question was something along the lines of, what can you do to help protect the citizens of Montana from SARS coronavirus? And at the time, I don't think it was obvious to many people that this was going to be as big of a problem in Montana as it's become. I don't think many of us would have guessed that 1 in 100 Montanans would have been affected by this virus. But I think with Jason's leadership, MSU has become one of the leaders in trying to address the pandemic. And there's a couple of different ways that MSU has been participating in this research effort. So what needs to be done? We need rapid and frequent tests. We need antiviral drugs. We need vaccines. And we need behavioral changes. And out of all these possible options, it seemed clear to me that the role that I might be able to participate in was to help with testing. And the way that we did this in the beginning was in a partnership with Bozeman Health. Bozeman Health had a lot of expertise to bring. They had access to sick people. They knew how to take samples from patients. They had all the regulatory infrastructure in place and knew how to abide by HIPAA regulations, so on and so forth. But what they didn't have is what MSU did have, and that was the expertise, the technical expertise, and the instrumentation to perform these tests. So this is a picture of Michelle Flanagan, a professor here at MSU in the Department of Plant Sciences. She took herself and her team up to the hospital along with some of her instruments to try to help train the research technicians or the diagnostic technicians up at the hospital to establish a SARS testing facility in Bozeman Health. And I think that getting that facility up and running and independently working to test for SARS coronavirus was a major milestone in getting ahead of this pandemic, or at least starting to address it. But that's not the end of the collaboration. That's really kind of been the beginning of the collaboration. Those patients that test positive, we bring those patient samples to MSU in a collaboration with a couple of other colleagues, Matthew Taylor and Mark Judula, as well as a couple of key individuals in Mark Judula's lab, Deanne Snyder and Jody Hedges. They've been isolating the RNA from these viruses. So you can think of viruses as genetic taxis that shuttle RNA from one cell to the next. And what they've been doing is pulling this RNA from the inside of this virus and handing that over to us. And then we've been using a technology called the nanopore sequencing technology. It's a new sequencing technology that's about the size of a harmonica or a Snickers bar to sequence SARS coronaviruses isolated from patients here in Bozeman. And the sequencing effort has been spearheaded by a few key individuals in my lab, Artem, Anya, Calvin, and Tanner. And what we do with these sequences, we now have about 60 complete genome sequences of SARS coronaviruses isolated from patients here in Bozeman, is we can compare all of these viruses from Bozeman to viruses that have been isolated from around the globe. We as a scientific community have about 60,000 SARS coronavirus genomes right now, and we can create something of a family tree of these SARS coronaviruses, and we can ask, how is the virus changing over time and space? And then the next phase of this question, which we can't answer right now, is we know it's changing, but the big question is do these mutations have any impact on the viral behavior, or does it affect ultimately patient outcomes? And to start to address those questions, we're teaming up with Mark Judula and his team again. Okay, so it's one thing to sample individuals within the community, but of course, the other approach is to sample the wastewater and test the community as a whole. We've been doing that since about mid-March. And so to do that, we go down to the Bozeman Wastewater Treatment Facility off of Spring Hill. And we go straight to the headworks. This is right where the wastewater comes into the wastewater treatment plant. This facility treats about 6 million gallons of wastewater every day. It's a pretty remarkable facility that I think kind of went overlooked before SARS coronavirus pandemic. With the help of some technicians there, we collect what's called a 24-hour composite sample. A sample is collected every hour for 24 hours. And then we bring those samples back to the lab and we use an assay called the quantitative PCR assay. It's akin to a molecular photocopy machine. Every time you copy the viral genome, you get a flash of light. The more virus you have in a sample, the more light you get. And so we can measure how much virus is in a particular sample. And the graph that you're seeing here, each of these triangles and spheres is plotting the amount of virus we're detecting in Bozeman's wastewater over time. You're starting towards the end of March, and then it trails off and goes below our detection limit for a couple of months. And since then, it's come back. And as many of you probably know, we're currently experiencing a bit of a spike. That data is not obvious on this graph, but if you look on the County Health Department's website, you can get an up-to-date information on the prevalence of SARS coronavirus in Bozeman's wastewater. The other thing that you see on these graphs the bars that are in the background here is that we're plotting the incidents or individuals that were testing positive on any given day. And then those individuals that tested positive were interviewed by county health professionals and asked when their symptoms started. So they tested positive. So that's why you see the shift to the left here. But the other thing that's important to point out is that by testing wastewater, we actually had 2 days advanced notice of when we were going to experience a surge in the community. So this study, which is an open access journal article that's available in Cell Reports Medicine, showed that wastewater testing is our best bet in terms of real-time indicators of a coming surge. Like I mentioned before, you can get access to this data at the County Health Department. If you scroll down here, you can see Bozeman. And if you click on Bozeman, you get the data that I was just highlighting on the previous graph over time, showing the occurrence or prevalence of SARS coronavirus in the wastewater, along with the epidemiological data in the background. And the same is true. Seth's lab has been working in Big Sky, West Yellowstone, and Three Forks, and you can find that same sort of data at that same location. I'll wrap up by just saying thanks again for the invitation. And if you want to find more information about CRISPRs or SARS coronavirus, you're welcome to visit our website. And this work has been largely spearheaded by the people I've already mentioned, Tanner, Calvin, Artem, Anya, as well as other projects in the lab that have now kind of spun out of this to develop new viral diagnostic methods, and then other people in the lab that are studying things that might not be related to coronaviruses. So with that, I'll turn it over to Seth.
Thank you so much, Blake. That was great. It's my pleasure, again, to be able to introduce Dr. Seth Walk, who is an associate professor in the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at Montana State University, specializing in infectious diseases, microbial ecology, and evolution and population genetics. His research aims to develop and apply theories of microbial ecology and evolution to help improve human and animal health and decrease disease. Specifically, his lab studies everything from how pathogens circulate within hospitals to how microbial communities improve human health. He's the author of over 60 peer-reviewed articles in a variety of prestigious journals, including the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Nature Communications, the Journal of American Pathology and Clinical Infectious Diseases, PLOS-1, and the Journal of Clinical Microbiology. So many, I can't even name them all. Also, I think it's really important to mention that Dr. Walk has served as a member of the Gallatin County Board of Public Health, and I know that he has worked tirelessly. I don't think many of our public health officials have slept much in the past several months. He's worked tirelessly for our community during this pandemic, and it's now my pleasure to turn things over to Dr. Walk.
Well, thank you, Kristen. That was a very generous introduction. Thank you to everybody who really organized this. This is a great effort, and just an outstanding public outreach for us scientists to present our research. This is quite an honor. Thanks, Blake, for kicking this off. That provided a really good introduction for what I'd like to cover today. And I did want to start with a little bit of biology. So we are professors, and we do like to teach. And I just wanted to mention that, you know, scientists are learning a lot about this virus. It's a brand new virus. We really haven't had much experience with it before this pandemic, but we're learning a lot very rapidly. And one of those areas of discovery that's pertinent to today is how this virus gets into human cells. And we're learning a lot about this process, but I'm just going to draw your attention to one part of it. That's the receptor that the viruses use to recognize our cells and gain entry. And in the human cells, that entry port is called ACE2. And it's not really important to understand what it does and all of the complexities, but where it's expressed. And I'm showing here a man and a woman in a picture that's just showing where this ACE2 is expressed in the human body. And you don't need to be a scientist to realize that there's a lot of this expression in the GI tract. And so the idea of looking for this virus in wastewater makes a lot of sense scientifically, but also biologically with the virus and how it gains entry into our bodies. And so when we come into contact with the virus, we're likely not only shedding it through our respiratory tract, but also through our gastrointestinal tract. And we're shedding that virus into the wastewater. And that's kind of why we can detect it in symptomatic folks. As Blake mentioned, my lab's been interested in testing and helping out in the effort to slow the spread of the virus. And so we jumped on board with wastewater testing using protocols developed in Blake's lab, and actually learned directly from the folks that work in Blake's lab to get up to speed. And we thought we could help out in Big Sky and West Yellowstone and in Three Forks, Montana. These are just two people in my lab, one of which was trained in Blake's lab and is now a postdoc in my lab that is doing the actual wastewater testing. All these results that we're generating can be found, as Blake pointed out, on the county's website, as well as our research site shown here for the Walk Lab. And on this site, we have links that you can click on for any date that the samples were done. When you click those buttons, you can get actually the data if you're interested in data, but you also get the summaries of what the result was for the overall test, as well as Blake's lab. We're also putting out these graphs showing the number of cases in the communities, and then overlaid on that what the levels of the virus are in the wastewater. So these efforts were done in close collaboration with the city county health department. And we learned some lessons that are helping the county do their job. And Blake mentioned these, but I just want to reiterate them. If there are symptomatic cases in the community, we tend to see it in the wastewater and vice versa. When the cases go away in the community or they're just not there to begin with, we really rarely detect it in wastewater. So this has been a very good surveillance tool to keep track of the virus and the levels in the community. So if that was all I was doing, I probably wouldn't be talking here today, but my lab became involved as well with another pretty big effort. In early July, the governor's office began to reach out to institutions across our state. And the reason for that is members of the Federal Task Force for COVID Response started talking to state officials that were noticing a lull in testing capacity. And tests were taking up to a week to get back from the state labs and other private labs that were doing the testing. And so to solve this problem, federal and state officials began working together to get a workaround to solve this problem. And one of the ways that they thought they could solve it was by running tests on academic labs. And the reason that this wasn't done at the get-go is because there's a federal agency that regulates all testing that's performed on humans called CLIA. And the idea was that you couldn't do a COVID test on a human without having a CLIA certified laboratory. And these are not trivial labs. There's a lot of regulatory things that need to be in place to run a CLIA lab. And oftentimes these are only found in medical institutions or hospitals. And so the workaround from the federal government was that you didn't need these CLIA certifications if you're gonna do what was called surveillance testing and you were gonna go out and screen in the community. And so at that point, we became involved through the governor's office, Governor Bullock, also Major General Matt Quinn, who's in the National Guard and the lead for the Montana COVID Task Force, along with Jim Murphy up at the Department of Public Health and Human Services. He's the state epidemiologist that helps run the testing for the state at the state lab. And these folks reached out to the Vice President for Research, Jason Carter, at MSU and began these initial talks. And that's where my lab became involved. And we started to partner with the state and get our testing capacity up and running. There was many people involved here. It was very much a team effort. And the governor and the task force leaders, this is Major General Quinn and the Fatigues here, along with Governor Bullock, they came down and we all discussed a plan of attack. And right about the time this picture was taken, it was reported that, hey, we kind of got that CLIA thing wrong. And actually, you do need CLIA certification to do these tests. And it was very fortuitous that we had a person that was qualified to do this. And her name was Deborah Kyle. And Deborah is our CLIA lab director. And she was able to have the credentials herself, but also get our lab up and running and CLIA certified. So a lot of credit is due to Deborah. So the flow of samples into our laboratory then, they come from sampling events in the community or around the state where folks get tested. And swab samples are taken and sent to the state lab in Helena at DPHHS. They route them here to Bozeman, to our lab, the COVID testing lab. And once we get our results, we send those back to the state, but also to the local health department here in Gallatin County, if that's where the samples originated. Now, if the samples originated somewhere else in the state, they get sent to those local health departments. So we're really connected through DPHHS to really every county and health department in the state. And once those health departments get contacted with the results, for example, here in Gallatin County, that triggers the health officer or the people in charge of quarantining and following up with folks to get help, to seclude those, to isolate these individuals so they don't spread the virus anymore. And Matt Kelly's been very instrumental in helping us get this down, both here locally on MSU campus and also up and running for the whole county and state. So I did want to show you a little bit about our lab. you don't want a lot of people touching these samples because we wanted to process many hundreds of samples. We were able to purchase these robots that really help us handle all of these samples and get the test results to be very accurate. And you can see this thing running. It's picking up sample over here, putting it over here. It's mixing things. It can add reagents. It just helps us do the science that we need to do in a very large quantity. You can see like these different plates set onto this robot, and this really helps us scale up and do the numbers of samples that are needed in our community and across our state. So one of the issues I did want to say that this didn't go off without a hitch. At first get-go, we were given a couple of sample tubes, and I'm showing those here. These sample tubes have a barcode, and that really helps us barcode and scan in the samples without having to write anything down and make errors that way. And we thought, okay, we got all of the system running on these types of sample tubes, but lo and behold, there was a shortage, and we began seeing a lot of different sample tubes. And what I'm showing you here is just a diverse collection of tubes that we get in each and every day, and we have to be able to work with these different kinds of tubes. And for that, we got with some engineers on campus that were able to design us some racks, and these racks fit right into our robots. There are rubber gaskets shown up here on the top that these tubes fit in, so we can actually handle any kind of tube that they throw at us. Any type of tube that becomes available and isn't limiting, now we can run these samples in the lab. And that was a really big leap for us. Here's a picture of our robots in the lab. We have three of them now that we have up and running. Here's just a picture of a cooler that we have in the lab. There's hundreds of samples in here, probably over 700 samples. There's three machines that we use to actually run the tests that on every sample. Each one of these machines can run 384 tests at a time. And we're running these about three times a day. So just a little bit of summary of where we've come. The initial contract with the state was to test 30,000 samples by the end of the year. Currently, we're running over 1,000 a day, and we're doing that 5 days a week, Tuesday through Saturday. And we offset a day because most of the sampling events happen over the weekend. So this allows us the quickest turnaround time. And we expect to complete this entire contract on October 9th. And that's a testament really to everybody has been involved with this. And all indications are we're going to have a new contract coming real soon to do a whole nother batch and keep our testing for the state up and running. So I did want to acknowledge the team. All of these folks were instrumental in this project. A lot of these folks, probably half of these folks, worked in my lab originally before COVID really hit, but then half of them were pulled in from other labs on campus and even from in the community when we advertised for full-time positions. I did want to point out a few folks in particular. Mike Dills is our lab manager and really developed a lot of our workflow that we use, really optimized a lot of things. We also have Sheena Wald and Gina Taylor. These folks have been instrumental in helping us order everything. You can imagine how many reagents and consumables that we go through to test this number of samples every day, as well as research compliance. So there's a lot of safety issues that are involved with testing these samples. And Kirk Lubick and Ryan Bartlett were instrumental in helping us get those hurdles overcome. And with that, I think I'm going to leave it. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much to both of you. That was really great. We have some questions that are starting to come in. I'm going to start with some of the questions about wastewater testing. Rob Meyer asked a question. First, just to clarify, are the virus particles in wastewater carried in there in feces, urine, or both? And then the second part, which is the harder part of the question, is it feasible to test wastewater specifically to, say, the MSU campus, like a residence hall, or target it to find out whether it's coming from, say, I don't know, a particular neighborhood, or how can we zone in on where the positives are coming from?
Maybe I'll take a first stab at it, and Seth can fill in the blanks. Well, I don't know of any study that's shown SARS coronavirus in urine, but I suppose that's conceivable. I am aware of several studies that have shown it directly in feces. It was a bit controversial whether we were just detecting evidence of the virus or if there was actually infectious virus particles that were still viable in the feces. There have been a couple of studies now that have shown that there are, on occasion, infectious virus particles in the feces. So I don't know if Seth can say more about the urine, but that's what I know about where it's coming from. can you back up the waste stream and identify specific regions in the community that are maybe hotspots? Yes, that's completely possible. It just takes more resources, more people to do those sorts of things. And we have a plan in place that's kind of been in process with the state and many people here at MSU to do some of that work to back up to what's called point of release, maybe not to a particular household, but rather to neighborhoods or the MSU campus. And then as some communities have done or some universities have done, you've probably seen they've backed it up to individual dorms and showing which dorms are starting to become positive. And of course, that's really valuable because then you can quarantine a dorm and slow down the spread pretty effectively.
Another question in relation to wastewater. So Andre Nakas asks, if wastewater can give a 2-day advance notice of COVID infection, if you're seeing that spike in the wastewater samples before we know a spike is coming, why don't we test wastewater even more frequently than once a week? Would it help to increase the frequency of testing of wastewater?
Yeah, I don't know what the frequency Seth is doing, but when we first started, we were starting at 3 times a week, and that was really just all we could manage. So the limiting aspect to the amount of testing is just resources and person power to be able to do all these assays. It would make sense to at least do it 3 days a week for the reason that that person insightfully pointed out. When we started, we were doing it 3 times a week. Then we transitioned once it went below the detection limit to once a week. And then we picked it back up again at 3 times a week. And we have intentions to scaling up again, but haven't gotten there just yet.
And I should point out too that testing the wastewater in the lab is definitely, it's the resources that limit that. But really, when you get a positive, that triggers a whole series of events in the public health realm. And the limiting factor there is you then have to go out to the community and find those individuals that are positive or find those individuals that are carrying the virus. And that's been super limiting. So we have enough trouble testing the asymptomatic folks or the symptomatic folks in our communities, let alone just going out and trying to do this kind of surveillance on that scale. So throughout the pandemic, reagents, disposables, things that we need to test people, symptomatic people, have been limited. And we got to be aware of that too. If we were unlimited by resources, we could do in fact that. We could go out and look at wastewater, zero down, and then test whole communities or neighborhoods. But in practice, we're kind of limited still by these reagents.
Just a quick follow-up for Seth on that point about the challenge of getting through the testing. So this is from Diane Stone. And the question is, what's the lab turnaround time from the collection of the sample to the results being transmitted or communicated?
So we get samples in consistently by 11 o'clock in the morning. And we report those back. At least 95% of the samples get reported back by 8 o'clock that night. Now, that's just the turnaround time for our lab. We have to remember there's the sample collection took some time, and then reporting on the state end back to the local health departments takes some time. So all told, you know, most samples are getting turned around within 24 hours, up to 48 hours.
I think this next question is probably for Blake, because it goes to what he had talked about in his presentation about mutations. This is a question from Trevor Douglas. Is there a dominant mutant that is prevalent in Montana, or is this changing over time? And is this different from dominant mutations found in other regions of the U.S.?
Yeah, that's a great question. We're just starting to get into the analysis now, but I guess one of the things that got us more interested in this is that in one of our early genomes, we saw an unusual mutation. And of course, we were skeptical and wondered if that was just an artifact of the way that we were processing the samples or the sequencing technique that we were using. So we verified that that was really a legitimate mutation. It's a deletion mutation. I can't say exactly where it was. And we've now noticed that this mutation happens, or we've detected this mutation at relatively high frequency in Bozeman. And then when we went and looked around the rest of the world, we noticed that this mutation is not rare in the rest of the world, but it hasn't been reported just yet. So we're in a little bit of a race to try to determine how common it is really around the globe. And I think really the biggest question is what does it mean in terms of the virulence of the virus or patient outcomes? And we don't know the answer to that. We don't really probably be able to do those kinds of experiments just because you wouldn't want to make a mutation in a virus like that and give it to people and see what happens. But the best that we can probably do is just to do it on cell culture, infect cells that are growing in a dish, and ask, does the virus replicate faster with this mutation, or do the cells die quicker, or do you have more cytopathic effects? Those kinds of questions.
A couple of other questions about testing. One more question about wastewater testing, and that is, are there other places in the U.S. that's doing wastewater testing? How overarching is this? Is this happening in other places? Is this specific to Montana?
I think we were early to the game, but Montana is no exception. This has become really vogue. And in fact, many countries, federally sponsored programs are now systematically monitoring wastewater. One thing to bear in mind is that unlike patient testing, where you take a swab from a patient and it gets processed in a very methodical or defined way, that's not necessarily what happens with wastewater testing right now. So each lab might have their own mojo or certain aspects about their protocol that they use that are slightly different from the protocols that are used in another lab. So we're not always comparing apples to apples. And I think that's an important advance for the field to make, is to have some sort of standard so that we can really compare across our results that from my lab, the results from Seth's lab that are coming out of Big Sky, the results out of Spain, and so on.
Both Barbara Hedberg and also John Carnegie had questions related to vaccines, worries about if the virus is mutating or if it's going to mutate, how might that impact the development or efficacy of a vaccine, potential vaccine? Does the work that either of you are doing give you any insight into what kind of vaccine might be efficacious?
Viruses are always going to mutate, and that's the case. We're not going to stop that. So the question then is, how efficacious is the vaccine going to be? And these types of questions are absolutely relevant. They're really difficult to answer. The best thing that we can do, though, and what's being done, I'm sure, in earnest around the world, is to look at other vaccines that have been effective against viruses and try to model those, at least as far as where the vaccine is likely to recognize the virus and these kinds of things. I can hand it over to Blake to talk about mutation rates and where they might be occurring in SARS-CoV-2. But this is, I do think it's relevant to point out that this, I think Francis Collins has said many times that this is sort of a moonshot enterprise, making the SARS-CoV-2 vaccine. It's going to be one of the quickest that's ever reached the human population, and just a Herculean effort. So I'm very confident that whatever they come out with is going to work, at least with some fine tuning, and I'm very hopeful.
Most of the vaccines that I'm aware of are currently focused on the spike protein of the virus. So getting back to the slide that Seth was showing just a few minutes ago, it's the protein that interacts with the receptor on the surface of the cell. And those interactions are really critical to the infection. So if the receptor binding domain, that spike protein, mutates, then a lot of times most of those mutations are going to result in a virus that can't get into the cell anymore. So by generating a vaccine that targets a really important part of the virus, you have a better shot at targeting something that's going to be preserved over long periods of time.
So a couple of questions about testing. These are two questions from Dan Kleismith. Why is it that we haven't had tests sooner than we did? Is this the sort of thing that we should have been prepared for and had a test in advance to? His question was, could the Obama administration have created a test? But I think the more difficult question is, what's going on with the rapid testing? Any ideas about why we don't have more rapid testing in the state of Montana and or everywhere? This is something that was first talked about in March or April, and it doesn't seem to be widely available. So just wondering if you have any insights about that.
I'll leave politics out of it, but the CDC did a great job at developing the test. Now, in hindsight, things could have been done differently, possibly more effectively, but we have a test that we still use today by the CDC, and it is the gold standard. So I think that we're in a decent shape. with the test and its performance. But the performance is why these rapid tests haven't become mainstream. Well, it's kind of twofold. It's the performance of those tests, but it's also how quickly they can be scaled up, manufactured, and then distributed across the country. But let's dwell on performance for 1 second. For every diagnostic test, there is something called a gold standard, meaning that we start somewhere and we look at that and we evaluate it. And then if a new test becomes available or comes to the market, we always test that against the gold standard. And if it's the same accuracy, it performs the same, then it can be distributed. If it's inferior, it's not really going to take off and it shouldn't probably be used above the gold standard. And right now, most of these rapid tests are just not as sensitive as the diagnostic test that's being performed in hospitals and in state labs around the country. And that's why CDC has been really reluctant to approve them and recommend their use. So there's a few subtleties in that statement, but I think by and large, rapid diagnostics will become available, but the ones that are available right now just might not be up to par.
Yeah, and another couple on testing. So another question is, how long is testing taking in Montana? Do either of you know that right now? We know that there was kind of a backup with testing where test results were taking a kind of long turnaround time when we had a spike in July. It's hard to tell, but it looks like we may be having another spike that's starting now. What can people expect in terms of turnaround time for testing?
Well, that's a great question, and the future is always hard to predict, but right now we're in pretty good shape with our capacity in the state. We have not only the state lab in Helena they're processing well over 1,300 samples a day. You have our lab that's doing over 1,000, and then there's a private company that they're sending samples to that are testing. I think they're testing almost 2,000 samples. That's their capacity. I mean, we do have a lot more capacity. We're in a much better shape now than we used to be. But remember, if things really get bad and capacity needs to expand, then we need the reagents, we need the manufacturing, we need the disposables. And those are the things that limit our capacity. It's not that we don't have the know-how or the people or the want or desire or demand. It's really the manufacturing process. Where do we get those reagents? Can that be scaled up? And how rapidly that can happen? And sometimes our hands are tied even at a state level. That needs to be more of a federal initiative.
Is that something that where more money, more resources would help? Is that one of the main issues?
Yeah, I don't know those issues. I think money is kind of not the problem. I mean, there's so much demand out there that I think the money is probably there. Let me give you an example. When the gold standard of qPCR, and I'm sure Blake and Michelle know a lot about this. Michelle Flanagan helped, as Blake mentioned, get the local hospital here at Bozeman Deaconess up and running. But they were sold these machines that required reagents that they could only purchase from one place. And when those reagents became limited, not only in Montana, but across the country, that really created a lot of stress and a lot of problems. And so the best thing I think we can do is to diversify in the way that we can test these samples. And there are plug and play kind of options that are available. There are alternative reactions and protocols that we can develop. And that's been our approach in the lab, is to get things that are modular so we can plug in things that are available for things that become limited.
I think that testing efforts in the state have been, for the most part, really well supported. So to just piggyback a little bit on what Seth was saying, I don't think that that's generally been the rate limiting step. It really oftentimes comes down to supply chain issues. And I think since most of the testing has really been focused on the quantitative PCR assay, the gold standard, as Seth says, the reagents and consumables necessary to perform that test have sometimes been limiting. There has been, I think, since we are continuing to learn and we're still in the very early stages of this pandemic, I think we're learning more and more about what the right approach to testing is. And I think as we get further into this, there's been an interesting conversation that's been happening about not rather the sensitivity of testing, but rather the frequency of testing. So there's more and more effort now to try to move to tests that we can provide at point of care that would allow individuals to test themselves. Although, of course, as Seth pointed out, they're not going to be nearly as sensitive as the gold standard, and they may not be as reliable. But I think sometimes, it's been shown mathematically that at a level of a pandemic, frequency is really the most important aspect of testing. So of course, we want the most sensitive, most reliable tests, but there are some compromises to be made here sometimes. And I think we're trying to settle on what those compromises are. But of course, there's all these regulatory agencies involved, and that's important because we don't want tests that are completely unreliable out there in the public. That'll do more harm than good. But I think it has been a little bit of a delicate dance trying to figure out where that balance is.
This actually has to do with the health department data. Are test results from community surveillance testing included in the health department data, or is it only the systematic or prescribed tests that are included in that data? When Big Sky or someplace has a big community surveillance, a testing event, do those results go into the health department data along with the rest of them, or how does that work?
A case definition of COVID is a symptomatic person. So if you're looking on the county's website and it says cases, that's probably referring to symptomatic individuals that go through either their healthcare provider or some other avenue and get tested through the county and the state. Now, the surveillance data, I would assume, is available. I'm not sure if that's available at the county, like you said, for Big Sky, or if that's available through the state. But those numbers are available at one of those two sites, but those are counted differently. So a positive in that sense, in an asymptomatic surveillance event, doesn't meet the case definition. And so they would do a follow-up with the person, do a formal, maybe even a retest, and then that person would be counted.
One of the frustrating challenges of having these virtual events is that you can't hear the gigantic room of people applauding you. But I will just also say that many people have written into the chat about how grateful they are to both of you, both for your presentations tonight and for all your hard work on these important issues. And I also want to alert you to our next October event, which will be Wednesday, October 28th, when we'll be hosting our third web event like this called Pandemic Politics and Polarization. So lots of interesting, controversial stuff. And it will be featuring Kaylin O'Connor from UC Irvine, as well as Eric Riley from MSU. We'll be leading a discussion about how polarization occurs and how it's occurred in relation to the pandemic. And Eric Riley will be sharing some of his most recent polling data on the state of Montana and people's beliefs and attitudes about that. So please, again, come back and join us on Wednesday, October 28th at 6 p.m. for that event. And thank you again. Thanks so much to both of you for taking the time to do this.
You have just heard a webinar entitled Slowing the Spread, How We Can Detect the Virus in Multiple Ways, recorded on September 23, 2020. It was hosted by MSU Bozeman's Initiative for Science, Technology, Ethics, and Society, and it featured Dr. Blake Wiedenheft and Dr. Seth Walk, associate professors in microbiology and immunology at Montana State University, who discussed their efforts to test for SARS-CoV-2 in wastewater and expand testing in Montana. Dr. Kristen Intiman, Director of the Initiative for Science, Technology, Ethics, and Society, moderated the discussion. You can find out more at www.montana.edu/stes/. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production, produced by Joy LaClaire for Gallatin Valley Community Radio, KGVM Bozeman.